Chapter 3. Cold Steel. Well Done. There are times when terror can be quiet, insidious, hidden. So it was now. Murder had been done. Cold-blooded murder, unbelievably clever in its execution. How it had been done, Val Easton did not pretend to know at the moment. Why, he might never know. But from the instant he was aware of Carmody's real mission, he knew it hooked up with Nancy Fraser. The man who had been lurking outside her cabin window was the one to explain this. And if Carmody had been removed so skillfully and ruthlessly, why not Nancy Fraser and her companion? Why not himself, now that he was identified with them? The deck officer returned.
"The coffee's easy to explain, sir," he told Captain McCragg. "This chap Carmody left an order with the steward to bring him coffee around midnight every night. Seems he was troubled with insomnia or something like that. Couldn't sleep if he didn't have his coffee in the middle of the night."
"He'll have no trouble sleeping now," the captain remarked grimly.
Dr. Sims fingered his Van Dyke thoughtfully.
"Queer, mighty queer," he murmured, glancing at the bodies.
"What?"
the captain rasped.
"This steward's death. Carmody had been dead for hours when the man arrived with the tray. The cabin was dark and the door was locked. It isn't reasonable to suppose that the killer remained in here all the time."
"No," admitted the captain testily. "He'd be a fool to do it."
"Exactly. The steward arrived, unlocked the door, stepped in, and died almost instantly. There was no struggle. There could not have been any noise, or someone out on the deck would have heard it. He simply died on the spot, as Carmody had done. From the position of the body, I would say he died as he was trying to back out the door."
"Damn it, man, something happened to him,"
the captain snorted impatiently.
"I can't suggest what it was,"
Dr. Sims remarked coolly. And there the matter rested. While preparations were being made to put the bodies in the morgue, Val casually glanced at the papers which had been taken from Carmody's coat. He found nothing that might help him, and left the cabin a few moments later with Nancy Fraser. They walked half the length of the deck before either spoke. Then Val said soberly,
"It looks pretty bad."
"I think I'll stay up tonight," Nancy said calmly. "I don't want to be found that way in the morning."
Val shot her a quick look.
"You think it touches you?"
"Don't you?"
she countered.
"Perhaps."
Nancy said with conviction,
"I'm not timid, but I have a hunch this is far worse than anything I've been up against before. This isn't wartime. Murder isn't on the cards now. An ordinary espionage agent wouldn't try a thing like that. It's creepy. Ghastly."
"American and British agents are out," Val said soberly. "Carmody didn't seem especially dangerous to me. I think you're right. You've walked into something bigger than you think."
"Big enough for murder,"
said Nancy slowly. She chuckled softly in a way that showed her nerve was unshaken and laid a steady hand on Val's arm.
"At least, my friend, we should be thankful we know as much as we do. We might have gone ahead blindly and drawn the same thing. Tomorrow is another day. We'll see."
Tomorrow was another day of bright sunshine over the fantastic, serrated skyline of New York as the big liner plowed slowly up to the bay. During the night, the ship had been in the grip of suppressed excitement. The bodies had been removed to the ship's morgue. The room had been locked and sealed. Wireless messages had crackled forth to shore. Passengers had been questioned, scrutinized. And at quarantine, detectives hastily summoned from shore had come over the side with the ship reporters. Flashlight pictures of the cabin were taken. Thumbprints were photographed. Passengers were diplomatically interrupted at their packing and last-minute preparations for going ashore and questioned suavely. The newspapermen probed like hawks. Val and Nancy were questioned by newspapermen and detectives. Their stories were brief and of little help. Of their business or the man who had been lurking outside Nancy Fraser's cabin window, nothing was said. Carmody, it appeared, was a man who had little to do with anyone outside of those he met at his meals. He had had no trouble with anyone, had no intimates. Val himself had radioed Washington in code before daylight, giving such details as he knew. Val took the message to Nancy Fraser. V. Easton, on board SS Laurentic. London disclaims knowledge of Carmody or interest in him save as British subject. Your identification as intelligence agent erroneous. On no account let it interfere with matter in hand. Work together until further instructions. Signed, Greg. When Nancy had read the decoded words, Val tore the message into bits and dribbled them over the rail.
Chalk up another puzzle on your list, he said dryly. If Carmody isn't a British agent, what is he? What was he doing with that badge? And why was he killed? It's more tangled than ever if we take that honor away from him.
Could it be possible, Nancy suggested, that London is pulling Greg's leg? Won't admit Carmody's their man for fear it might tip their hand on something they're anxious to keep hidden?
Quite possibly. It's been done plenty of times before. Carmody's dead. They can't help him now. And again, they may have told the truth.
The badge.
He might have found it. Nancy tossed her head.
Badges like that aren't left lying around for people to find. What about his gun?
People carry guns.
It's an official issue.
Might have found it, too, Val grinned.
Your suggestions grow worse,
Nancy told him.
Val lit a cigarette. We're cleared on it, anyhow. Greg seems a trifle annoyed. Suppose I pick your man up when he leaves the customs and get in touch with you at your hotel. Give you a little leisure that way. I don't think we'll be held on board. They won't detain a shipload of people without evidence.
That would be nice,
Nancy nodded.
We'll go to the Blockman.
No one had shown any interest in them that morning, and yet Val could not shake off the feeling that he was being watched. He tried every trick he knew to prove it, and got nowhere. The feeling persisted, irritating him, finally. Nerves, he told himself. And yet he knew it wasn't. They were both under silent, insidious scrutiny, and there was nothing worse. And the thought of Carmody horribly dead behind a locked door made things no better. Val had been right about the ship's passengers. Among them were many influential people who could not even be considered as suspects. The men from shore were as baffled as the ship's company had been. They had no clues, no concrete suspicions. Names and addresses were taken and other data, but nothing else was done. The debarkation was underway in full force shortly after the ship was moored in her berth. Val had looked up Galbraith, studied the man from a distance. He was typically British in a quiet, unassuming way. A sparse, medium-billed man in tweeds, with a long, pale, unsmiling face, a neatly trimmed mustache, an indifference to his surroundings that bespoke much travel. He conversed with no one, kept to himself. Carmody's death, of which Galbraith evidently knew, aroused no visible interest in the man. Val followed him that morning on a stroll around the deck, noticed that Galbraith did not even glance at the door of Carmody's cabin. And Galbraith's manner when he left the ship was leisurely and indifferent. He went to the G section in the customs lineup, stood by indifferently while his kit bags were examined, and then followed a porter and the bags to a taxi. Val had managed to have a few words with the man in charge of his own luggage. His bags were mysteriously passed and whisked out of line. Val caught a taxi ahead of Galbraith. Outside the pier shed, he ordered the driver to wait. A few moments later, they were following Galbraith's cab. Galbraith did not look back, seemed not to suspect he might be followed. Val kept watch behind to see if any cab was noticeably following him. But in the crowded traffic, it was almost a hopeless gesture. Galbraith went directly to the Rosecrans, one of the big hotels overlooking Central Park from 59th Street. He entered the lobby behind his luggage in time to see Galbraith step into an elevator. The card registration system was in use at this hotel. There was no way of telling what room Galbraith had been given. Val smiled disarmingly at the clerk and tried a random shot.
My friend, Mr. Galbraith from London, told me on the boat he was going to register here. I'd like a room near him, if possible.
Mr. Galbraith has just registered, the clerk replied. Let's see, I can give you room 717. That's just across the corridor from him. Mr. Galbraith is in 716.
Excellent, Val nodded.
As soon as he was settled in his room, he telephoned Nancy.
Nora and I will come over there and register,
Nancy said.
If he goes out, follow him. We must know whom he sees.
But Galbraith did not go out at first. He had a caller. Through his door, which had been left ajar an inch or so, Val saw a gray-clad back as the visitor was admitted to Galbraith's room. Just a glimpse, and then the door closed on them as Galbraith said formally,
"How do you do, Mr. Raimi?"
The two were closeted in Galbraith's room for half an hour. In that time, Nancy Fraser and her companion registered, and Nancy telephoned from their room on the third floor. Val told her of Galbraith's visitor, suggested she be ready to tail him when he left. Val was sitting inside his door when Galbraith's visitor stepped out into the hall once more. He heard the man say unctuously,
"Tomorrow night at Oak Ridge, then. Follow those directions after you reach Washington, and you can't miss it."
And the fleeting glimpse through the cracked door showed a stocky, pasty-faced fellow whose down-snapped hat brim shaded features that were as unctuous and oily as his voice had sounded. Before he was a dozen paces down the hall, Val had closed the door and was at the telephone calling Nancy's room.
"All right, catch the next elevator," he rapped to her. "Blue suit, pudgy, pasty face, brim of gray hat snapped down."
"Right,"
said Nancy briefly, and her receiver clicked. Val was smiling thinly with satisfaction as he lighted a cigarette and resumed his watch at the door again. Galbraith's visitor would have a hard time shaking her. But as he conned over his one hasty glimpse of the fellow, his smile faded to a thoughtful scowl. Raimi was a queer person to be calling on Sir Edward Lynn to give Galbraith his right name. If long experience in judging people at a glance held good, Raimi was a shyster, tricky, smooth, untrustworthy. Tomorrow night at Oak Ridge, near Washington, what was behind that rendezvous which had been arranged? Galbraith left his room shortly. He walked down Fifth Avenue and over to Times Square, slowly window shopping. He went to two of the Times Square newsreel theaters, window shopped some more, dined leisurely, and walked back to the hotel with a leg-weary Val Easton still within sight of him. Val called Nancy Fraser's room when he got in. Nora Beamish answered instantly, and her voice was sharp with worry.
"You haven't seen Nancy?"
she queried anxiously.
"No, isn't she in?"
"I haven't heard from her since she went out this afternoon," Nora informed him. "Do you think something could have happened?"
"I doubt it," Val reassured her. "She'll show up in a little while. Have you eaten?"
"I had some food sent up," Nora told him. "I won't leave the room until I hear from her. She may telephone."
"If she does, let me know. And if she comes back, have her telephone my room at once. I'll leave word at the desk if I go out."
Galbraith seemed set for the time being. Val hastily stripped, took a hot shower, and dressed again. He found himself wondering about Nancy Fraser. Had something happened to her? She was the kind of girl who would take chances. Val found it impossible to forget those two still forms on the Laurentic, grim warning of the price of carelessness. He had barely finished dressing when Knuckles rapped sharply on the door. Val answered it with a feeling of relief. It must be Nancy, returned finally and come up for a word with him. He opened the door with a grin on his face. And the grin faded to astonishment. A black-coated waiter confronted him, bearing a cloth-covered tray.
"You've made a mistake," Val told him. "I didn't order anything."
The waiter looked doubtful.
"Mr. Easton, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"This is right, then. A young lady telephoned down and said to bring this order to your room. It's for two. I believe she is supposed to share it also."
"Oh," said Val blankly. "All right, bring it in."
His reaction was pleasure. This was such a thing as Nancy Fraser would do. Thoughtful of her. Eat while they talked. She was back then, and everything was all right. And he wondered what news she was bringing. The waiter had a small folding rack under his arm. Opening it, he set the tray carefully down. He was a swarthy, poker-faced man with powerful shoulders bulging inside his black jacket and wrists which protruded out of sleeves that were too short.
"The young lady said to cook the steak well done,"
he declared.
"Will you see it now, sir?"
From the moment the fellow had entered the room, closing the door behind him, Val had been struggling with a feeling of bafflement. Something was out of place in this picture. Wouldn't Nancy have telephoned him, after all, as soon as she got in? And he hadn't been under the shower more than a few minutes. Hardly long enough to have a steak well cooked and a full meal sent up to the room after she returned. And there was something else. Suddenly, he got it. How the devil did this waiter know that the woman who ordered the dinner over the telephone was a young woman? He couldn't know. And the man's coat was too small, his face was tanned where a man used to working indoors would be pale. And a degree of insolence had come into his manner. He leered at Val across the tray as he whisked the cloth away. One look was enough to tell Val that his suspicions had been right, for the dishes that had obviously contained food a short while before were empty now, and in the midst of them lay a large, flat automatic. Val jumped for that gun instantly. It was a long chance, and it failed. A muscular hand closed over the gun, and its muzzle jerked up and met him. Val stopped short, arms tensed at his sides. For a moment, silence held the room, while Val's eyes locked with a pair of dead slate eyes which stared at him with a cold, unwinking gaze. Politeness, mockery, pretense were now gone.
"Lift your hands,"
the other ordered across the littered tray. "What's the idea?" Val countered.
"Shut up. Don't argue. Put your hands up."
As he spoke, the others stepped around to Val's side. The gun was steady in his hand, and his manner was venomous. A slight foreign accent tinged his words. Slowly, Val raised his arms.
"Turn around."
Val did that, too, and a second later, steel crashed against the side of his head brutally. Everything went blank, black. He pitched forward to the floor. Chapter 4 The Hollow Needle. The light overhead was still burning brightly when Val's eyes opened again. He was stupid for a moment, senses whirling, pain roiling in his head. He couldn't think what it was all about. And then he remembered. The waiter, the cloth-covered tray, the gun, the stunning blow against his head. The tray was still sitting on the rack in the center of the floor before him, the white cloth tossed on the floor and the soiled dishes mocking him. The waiter and his gun were gone. The room was silent, deserted. And there by the side of the bed, Val sat in the straight-backed chair, tied hand and foot with lengths of fine silk cord. His ankles were fastened to the legs of the chair and his arms were tied behind it. Silk cord was lashed about his wrists so tightly the circulation had been cut off. His hands were numb. Cloth had been stuffed into his mouth and tied in place by a towel, making an extremely uncomfortable but highly efficient gag. He was helpless, miserable, and impotent. As his predicament burst over him, Val's first reaction was a struggle to free himself. He quickly saw it was impossible. He couldn't rub the gag out of his mouth and call for help. Over his shoulder, he saw that the window had been closed and the shade pulled down. The phone was on the other side of the bed. By the side of the door was the bell button that would quickly bring help. Only a few feet away, and yet it might have been as many miles. Val raged at himself for a moment. He had been a fool to be caught off guard that way. And yet it had been smooth work, well planned and executed. Whoever had done it had known about his connection with Nancy Fraser, had known that Nancy was out and might be back any time. Only one man could have known that. The one who had been watching them on the Laurentic. What was the reason for it? Not Nancy. She was out of the hotel. Hardly Nora Beamish on the lower floor. Galbraith, then. Galbraith across the hall where Val's door commanded his, where no move could be made without danger of interruption. He didn't know how long he had been tied here in the chair before regaining consciousness. It might have been minutes or an hour or more. In that time, what had happened to Galbraith? Val eyed the telephone narrowly. If he could inch the chair around to it, he might tip the phone over. Using his toes and throwing the weight of his body at the same time, he managed to shift the chair inch by inch. But it was slow, hard work. Perspiration broke out on his forehead. And in the midst of that, the telephone suddenly buzzed. Val cursed behind his gag. That was Nancy or Nora, and he couldn't answer. It was maddening to know help was so near and be unable to summon it. The telephone buzzed again and again, and then stopped. He hadn't covered a quarter of the distance to the instrument. Stubbornly, Val kept on. And then a few minutes later, a key grated suddenly in the door. A bareheaded, broad-shouldered stranger stepped into the room, took one look, and uttered in a startled voice,
"Hey, what's this?"
From behind his back, Nancy Fraser darted into the room. Relief broke over her face as she saw Val staring mutely at her. With a swift little rush, she reached his side, snatched the towel down, and pulled the wadded cloth out of his mouth.
"Thanks,"
Val mumbled through cramped lips.
"Who did this?"
Nancy asked tensely.
"Fellow disguised as a waiter. Get across the hall and see if Galbraith's all right. I think they got me out of the way because of him."
"This looks mighty funny to me,"
the broad-shouldered stranger said ponderously.
"You hurt, buddy?"
Val had him placed by now, a hotel detective already muddled and uncertain about everything.
"I telephoned as soon as I got in,"
Nancy said swiftly.
"When you didn't answer, I queried the desk, and they said you hadn't left any word there. I suspected something was wrong, so I got the hotel detective to come up here with me and unlock your door."
Nancy whirled around on the detective.
"Cut him loose from there,"
she snapped.
"Where's your master key?"
The master key was produced with a puzzled frown. Nancy snatched it and made for the door.
"Hey, where are you going with that?"
the detective protested. But Nancy whirled out of the room without answering either of them. The detective turned after her in indecision.
"Is that dame gone nutty?"
he uttered plaintively.
"Cut these damn ropes," Val snarled. "Don't stand there like a lunkhead. Get me out of this chair."
The fierce command in his voice brought the desired result. The detective's thick fingers fumbled open a small pocket knife, and he hacked at the cords. Val was chafing his wrists and wringing circulation back into them as the detective stooped over and slashed at the cords around his ankles. Val staggered to his feet. From across the hall keened a cry of distress that broke off sharply in a choked gasp. Nancy's voice. Val plunged for the doorway without stopping for the gun in his bag. Galbraith's door was standing ajar. He crashed it open with his shoulder and plunged into the room, into a scene of confusion and violence. The place had been looted hurriedly. Bureau drawers were out and their contents tossed heedlessly on the floor. Bags had been slit open with a sharp knife and searched hastily. The closet door was open, a bed turned down, and Galbraith's body lay huddled in the center of the floor. All that went unheeded, for before him Nancy was fighting off a tall, stooped, black-caped figure which clutched her throat with one long, talon-like hand as it tried to wrench its other hand from Nancy's desperate grip. They staggered around as Val entered the room. A pale, ghastly, cadaverous face turned toward Val. He was aware of a parted, writhing mouth, of blazing, green-flecked eyes, of teeth that showed momentarily like fangs. It was the face of a monster, a fiend, lashed by murderous fury, indescribably venomous, vicious, dangerous. Some horrible fate had been in store for Nancy. The hand she clutched so desperately held no gun, no knife, no club. Its talon-like fingers were tensed about the small, gleaming barrel of a doctor's hypodermic, and the long, sharp needle was bending in toward her wrist with all the shuddery menace of a deadly serpent's fang. As the door slammed shut behind Val, he threw himself at that sinister black-caped figure. A swift turn brought Nancy between them. She was hurled violently back, her grip tearing away. Val's arms saved her from a bad fall. Behind him, the house detective hammered violently on the door, bawling,
"Open up inside there!"
"Look out!"
Nancy gasped warningly.
"He'll kill you!"
Her words were too late. A hand plunged under the black cape as its wearer backed toward the open window. It came out with something that looked like a small, shiny metal fountain pen. But the instant he saw it leveling at them, Val knew better. He tried to shove Nancy behind him, and was too late. There was a dull pop. A whitish ball of vapor leaped at them, expanded rapidly, enveloped them. And suddenly they were blinded with tears, coughing, choking, sneezing, and fighting for breath.
Helpless, Val backed toward the door, sweeping Nancy with him when his arm touched hers. He was thinking of that vicious hypodermic needle and the man who wielded it. They were at his mercy now. It had been long since Val Easton had known such fear. And it was for Nancy Fraser, not himself. When the tear gas cleared out of the room, would she be stretched out there on the floor as well? The door was shaking before the assault of the house detective. The commands to open up were growing loud and furious. The tumult guided Val to the door. That Dick had a gun. His hand found the knob, and still nothing had happened to him as he turned that knob. For some reason, the black-caped attacker was holding back. The door was shoved in violently against him, knocking him off balance.
By God, what's the idea of all—
The houseman bawled as he charged in, breaking off into a fit of sneezing and choking before he could finish the question. Val was mopping at his streaming eyes with his handkerchief, trying to see. The Dick blundered into him. The hard muzzle of a gun poked roughly into his ribs.
Watch that gun, you big ox, Val yelled. You'll shoot the wrong person.
The gun was pulled away.
Come out in the hall,
Nancy choked. Val stumbled out after her. And there, away from the insidious gas, they gained a measure of control and sight. The house Dick was standing in the doorway, mopping at his eyes and swearing under his breath. Peering blearily at Val, he raved.
Did you shoot that stuff off?
Do I look like it? Val retorted. Is that fellow in the room yet?
What fellow?
Tall chap with black cape.
Peering through the doorway, the Dick said angrily,
There ain't no one in there. Hell, is that him on the floor?
But it was Galbraith's body he spoke of. It had not moved since Val first saw it. Air was pouring through the doorway, driving the last of the gas out the window. Wiping his eyes and peering as best he could, Val edged into the room. The tall, black-caped figure had vanished. From nearby rooms, other guests had poured out into the corridor, gathering around the door now. A woman caught sight of Galbraith's body on the floor and gave a stifled cry.
Get back, you folks,
the houseman ordered through his teeth. Val looked out at them.
Did anyone escape from this room? He demanded.
One of the men said flatly,
I was looking when the door was opened. You two men and the young lady were the only ones who came out. What happened?
Val hurried over to the window without answering. It was open, and when he looked out, he saw four stories below the dark roof of an adjoining building. It was to this window that Nancy Fraser's assailant had been backing when Val last saw him. He hadn't gone out into the hall. He wasn't here in the room. He must have gone out the window. But the sheer side of the tall building offered no refuge. There was no ledge by which he could have gained an adjoining window, no fire escape near, no ladder of any kind up or down, and yet it was the only way he could have left the room. Val whirled on the houseman, jerking a thumb at Galbraith's body as he did so.
The man who did that went out the window, he rapped out. He may have fallen. I can't see the roof down there very well. Better search it and the building underneath, and the hotel here. He was tall, thin, wore a black cape and dark suit.
So fast and furious had everything happened that this was the first chance for more than a fleeting look at Galbraith. Val dropped to his knees beside the motionless body as he spoke. Galbraith lay on his face, one arm under his head, the other thrown out awkwardly. He was dreadfully still and limp, had no pulse in neck or wrist. And as Val lowered the lifeless wrist, his gaze was caught by a tiny smear of blood just below the coat sleeve. Taking care not to disarrange the body before the medical examiner viewed it, he bent over and scrutinized the spot closely. Skin and flesh had been punctured by a needle-like instrument. A drop or two of blood had welled out before the wound closed. An area of flesh around the spot, no larger than a dime, was discolored slightly. That was all. And yet Val shivered as he rose to his feet, rubbing his hands slowly together. He was thinking of that glistening hypodermic needle in those talon-like hands. The hotel Dick was staring at him with wide eyes.
Is he dead?
He queried, nodding at the body.
Very, Val answered dryly. Better call the police, and then get down after that man.
The detective had closed the door against the curious in the hall. He stepped to the telephone, called headquarters, and reported the matter.
and then swung around and glowered at Val and Nancy.
"I didn't see anyone else in here," he said deliberately. "I'll just wait here with you two until the coppers come."
Chapter 5. The Black Doctor. It took Val a moment to realize that he and Nancy Fraser were under suspicion, and when he did, a wave of anger rushed through him.
"You fool," he said crisply. "Can't you see we didn't have anything to do with this? I was tied up in the other room, and Miss Fraser was only in here a few seconds. You heard her cry out, didn't you? And you got a dose of the gas that chap left."
"No one could have got out of here," was the stubborn answer. "If there was a guy, he jumped, and he's down there on the roof dead. And if there wasn't, you two can explain it to the cops. Better sit down there on the bed and make yourselves comfortable."
Nancy Fraser met Val's angry glance with a philosophical shrug.
"He's gone by now, anyway," she said. "We might as well make the best of it. I've got something to tell you."
While talking with the detective, Val had been conning over something else in the back of his mind. That pale, furious face with the blazing, green-flecked eyes had been strangely familiar. He was certain he had not seen the man before, and equally certain he knew something about him. Nancy's face was pale from the shock she had just experienced, but her voice was steady.
"That man," she said under her breath, "did you ever see him before?"
"No, but I've a feeling that I should have," Val confessed.
"I saw him once in Switzerland,"
Nancy declared.
"He was pointed out to me in Geneva. That was Karl Zacken, better known as the Black Doctor."
"Good God, the Black Doctor?"
"Yes."
And neither of them needed to say any more. Through the shady secret channels of international espionage, tales of Karl Zacken, the Black Doctor, seeped like fantastic nightmares. He was in the way of becoming a legend to those who dealt in such matters. There were men willing to swear that no such person existed, but they did not know the facts. No country claimed the Black Doctor, and he served none more than momentarily. Master spy, incredibly clever, cold-blooded, ruthless, a wizard at disguise. The Black Doctor gave orders to a wide-flung web of desperate characters. That much was definitely known. How many people received those sinister orders, only the Black Doctor himself knew. At times he worked alone, and at others as many as a score had helped him. His influence was like an evil miasma. When murder suited his ends, he killed with technical skill. If torture would help, he used torture with all the fiendishness of expert medical training. He was an adept at languages and disguise, and his favorite role was that of a doctor, friend of man and trusted by everyone. For, so rumor had it, Karl Zacken had once been a doctor. He dealt in information for the most part, stopping at nothing to get what he wanted and selling the results to the highest bidder if he could not use them better himself.
"Are you certain he was the Black Doctor?" Val urged in amazement.
"The man who pointed him out had been caught by the Black Doctor once. He'd never forget him, and warned me never to. We only caught a glimpse of him, but I marked that face for good. This was the man."
Nancy smiled wryly.
"And I had to meet him without a gun."
"What happened?"
Nancy gave a little shudder.
"He jumped at me just as soon as I slipped through the door. I caught one glimpse of his face and that hypodermic in his hand and knew what I was up against. I tried to scream for you, and he caught me by the throat. All I could do was try and keep that needle away. There was murder in his face. It was ghastly."
"And a good thing you dodged it," Val said soberly. "Galbraith evidently didn't."
"Was that what killed him?"
"Needle puncture in the wrist. If he'd had time, he'd probably have cleaned the smear of blood away, and there would have been another mystery for the police to solve."
"You think he was on the ship?"
"Who else?"
"But why kill that poor devil Carmody?"
Nancy asked.
"Ask the Black Doctor. He must have a good reason. He's after something."
"What?"
"God knows. Galbraith here knew, and he's dead."
"Do you think he got it?"
"He tried hard enough," Val said, looking around the looted room. "I don't know. Evidently he was still busy when you walked in on him." Val's jaw set.
He killed that chap on the boat and Galbraith here in cold blood. It wasn't a question of putting him out of the way while he searched the room. He simply slaughtered him and then went about his business. Evidently came all ready to kill.
Was he the man who tied you up?
No. Must have been one of his men. And clever work it was. The fellow came to the door disguised as a waiter, saying he had brought a meal you had ordered for us. I let him in without thinking, and when I did tumble that something was wrong, it was too late. He had a gun on me then. Knocked me out and trussed me up.
I can't understand why they didn't kill you, Nancy said. It would have been easy enough.
Val rubbed his forehead and shook his head. Lord knows, he admitted. It would have been easy enough, all right. They were silent for a moment.
That pseudo-waiter must have left a trail around the hotel here someplace,
Nancy muttered. I'm not worrying about him, Val shrugged. I'm worrying what this is all about. Why kill Galbraith and search his room here? He could have done it just as easily on the boat. Even the Black Doctor doesn't go around killing people for the fun of it. He could have left Galbraith alive just as well as he did me if he had only wanted to look through his things. What about that chap you followed? He had evidently made a date to see Galbraith somewhere near Washington tomorrow. He was an oily-looking bird.
Wasn't he?
Nancy agreed.
And a suspicious one, too. I think he was afraid someone might be following him. He tried all the tricks to shake anyone off.
Do you think he saw you? Nancy rubbed the side of her nose carelessly and shrugged.
I've cut my teeth at that sort of thing. I'm pretty sure he didn't see me. After riding around town, taking the subway, ducking into a movie, and out a side exit right away, he finally went into a telegraph office and sent a wire.
Who to?
I didn't have a chance to find out. I wanted to see what else he did.
The little bloodhound, Val grinned. Did you?
I did. He popped into a telephone booth in a cigar store and then took the elevated to Battery Park and went through the aquarium.
What?
'Pon honor, he looked at all the little fishes like he was going into his second childhood, and then met a man and woman back in one of the dark corners and talked at least 15 minutes with them.
What did they look like?
It was shadowy where they were standing,
Nancy said.
I couldn't see them well, and my man left first. I had to tag him. He chivied back uptown on the L again, got off at 42nd Street, hailed a taxi, and I lost him there. I couldn't get another cab quick enough. Any other time, there would have been a dozen on hand.
It doesn't matter. He's going to Washington. Nancy arched a delicate eyebrow.
How do you know?
Before Val could reply, the door burst open and admitted the hotel manager, patrolmen, and detectives. The law took charge of the situation, and the ponderous house detective stated his case flatly.
That lady there, waving his hand at Nancy, comes down and says I will come up and open a door for her. She thinks maybe there's trouble, and when I do, that gentleman is tied up in a chair. While I'm cutting him loose, she takes my key and runs into this room. He follows her, and they slam the door in my face. I don't know what happened in here, but when they opened the door, the room was full of tear gas, and that body was on the floor. They tried to tell me there was another guy in here who knocked him off, but I didn't see no one. There wasn't no way he could have gotten out. So when they tried to run me off the scene after this guy they claim was in here, I call headquarters and sit on the lid.
Though no direct charge was made, the house detective's story was damning as he told it. A brusque, lantern-jawed detective seemed to be in charge of things. He had examined the body and made a quick survey of the room while the houseman talked. Now he stepped to the window, looked out, and turned on Val and Nancy.
No one could have gotten out that window, he rasped at them. What's the straight of this?
What's your name? Val asked coolly.
I'm Lieutenant Ives of the Homicide Squad, and since this is a murder, I warn you to make your statements correct.
Step into the bathroom with me, Lieutenant Ives, Val requested curtly. Ives hesitated, fingering his lantern jaw, and then said gruffly,
All right, if it'll make you feel any better.
Val closed the door behind them and met Ives' scowl with an icy stare. I didn't bother to reason with that addle-pated fool who suspected us, he said icily. I'm going to tell you what happened, and then I want to get away as quickly as possible. You can check us at Washington, of course. Val palmed a small badge for Ives to see. The detective took one look at it and whistled softly. His manner changed abruptly to fraternal courtesy.
"I couldn't know," he apologized. "What's the lowdown on all this?"
Val told him what had happened.
"What's your interest in this fellow who got bumped off?"
Ives asked when he finished. "Well, that doesn't matter," Val refused him. "A lot of things don't matter right now. The man who killed him went out that window, may have gone up a rope ladder to a window above or slid down a rope to that roof below."
"Where's the rope, then?"
Ives demanded skeptically. "A hard flip from below on the rope would have loosened the hook over the window. You may find marks on the sill made by the hook. I'd suggest you try and trace him, and look over this hotel for a check on the pseudo-waiter who took me in."
"I don't need to," Ives commented. "Coming up in the elevator, the manager told me they had just found a waiter who had taken a meal up to room 701 and hadn't returned. They found him tied up and minus his coat. The tray and dishes he had brought up were gone also. The fellow who had occupied the room had checked out 10 minutes before. All the waiter could say was that as soon as he brought the tray into the room, he was knocked out, and when he came to, stuffed under the bed, two men were eating the meal as if he wasn't there. He didn't get a look at them."
Val thought with unwilling admiration that the black doctor would have the nerve to stop and eat part of the meal, which had evidently been ordered to get the waiter and tray where they could be used. But he said nothing of that. Too much information might throw obstructions in their way. For there was small doubt in Val's mind now that this murder of Galbraith was only a move in another, bigger game that the black doctor was playing. And it was that game in which he was most concerned. Time enough when it was uncovered to think about bringing the black doctor to book for murder. Ives took out a little black book and wrote down the description of the black doctor and the man who had impersonated the waiter. He asked for more information. Val referred him to Washington. Ives gave up with a shrug.
"I don't know what it's all about," he confessed. "You evidently know what you're doing. I'll call headquarters and they can let the commissioner decide what to do."
"Tell him to get in touch with Washington at once," Val ordered. "We've got work to do. Later on, we can return for testimony."
"It's unusual," Ives warned.
"Washington will settle it." And Washington did settle it in a bit less than an hour. Such was the power of that secret arm of the government which Nancy Fraser and Val Easton represented. Neither of them knew exactly what had flashed back and forth over the wires, but Ives himself, still at the hotel, answered a telephone call and told Val with a wry grin,
"I guess you two have got something on the ball, all right. Orders from the commissioner himself ought to let you go and forget about you for the time being. So long, and luck to you."
"We'll probably need it," Val said.
Val regarded the penciled message which he had obtained from the manager of the telegraph office. It had taken pressure to get a look at it, against all rules of the company. But it told him what he wanted to know. J.B. Tilson, Oak Ridge Manor, Hartsville, Virginia. Party arriving tomorrow. Signed, Ramey. So Galbraith had intended to meet Ramey at Oak Ridge. Hartsville, Virginia was close to Washington. The answer to everything must center there. He returned to the hotel and looked in at Nancy Fraser's room on the way to his own.
"Pack up," he said with a grin. "There's just time to catch the next plane to Washington."
Nora Beamish shifted her ample form on the edge of the bed and said tartly,
"Nancy needs a good night's rest. She's been through an ordeal, young man."
"That's right," Val said contritely. "Get your rest then, and I'll run along."
Nancy had just been powdering her nose when Val stepped in, and a nice nose it was, too, he noted. She tossed the powder puff on the dresser and stretched slender arms over her head, yawning luxuriously like a lazy cat.
"Nonsense," she said cheerfully. "I'm just getting warmed up. You must stay here and get the rest, and we'll run on."
Nora Beamish charged to her feet like a formidable battle cruiser getting underway.
"Leave me here," she snorted. "My great-aunt's transformation, you will. Do I look like an old grandma who needs to be parked in the corner? The idea, I won't have it. Where are those bags, Nancy? Get packed, young man, we'll be ready."
Though Nancy had disavowed fatigue, when the wide-winged monoplane swept off the lighted landing field with a roaring rush, climbed high and swiftly dropped the blazing panorama of lights that were New York back over the horizon, she promptly closed her eyes. Nora Beamish sat behind her with a defiant tilt to her chin. When Val looked at her, he received a visible sniff. Plainly, Nora held him responsible for the suggestion that she be left behind to take her ease. Val grinned and then glanced across the aisle at the smooth curve of Nancy's throat. Her eyelids lifted, and she smiled lazily at him, and then they closed and she seemed to doze. What a girl, Val thought. Nerves like steel, inexhaustible energy, ready to tackle anything. She had come through an ordeal that would have reduced most women to nervous hysteria. And now, knowing that they were pitting their wits against Carl Zachen, the dreaded Black Doctor, she was dozing as peacefully as an untroubled child. He felt a slight tightening of his throat as he remembered again that heart-stopping moment when death had grazed her wrist. And hard on the heels of that, Val felt a cold chill as he wondered what lay ahead for her before this business was done. The Black Doctor had not earned his reputation without cause, and somewhere at this very moment, he was moving craftily through the mystifying web he was spinning about them.